CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, it's voting day for Vancouver Quadra residents. We'll give you more details on that coming up, plus arts, sports, and your five-day weather forecast coming up in this half hour right here on News 101. But first this evening, we bring you some news on the UBC farm. As you may have heard recently, the farm has been rumored to be in for some challenges with the UBC administration over its future. There hasn't been a lot of information out there, leading people to wonder exactly what is happening. This evening, I am joined in studio by Friends of the Farm Representative Gavin Wright. So Gavin, can you just start by telling us a little bit about the farm?
Sure. Thanks, Rita. Tell a little bit about the farm. Maybe I'll start with how the farm got started.
Yeah, sure.
The farm site is down on South Campus, and so it's a 5-minute bike ride from the main UBC bus loop. Fairly close to campus if you have a bike. The farm has been there since the 1960s, so the land was cleared in the 60s. And it was used as a research farm from the 60s through to the 90s. In the 90s, it wasn't really being used too much in the late 90s. And then in 2000, it was reinvented as mm-hmm. a student farm.
Okay.
And basically from that point, it's been working as a student working model farm. It is now the last working farm in Vancouver. And basically we strive to provide learning, research, community outreach in sustainable agriculture.
Okay, so how big are we talking here? How much space is there?
So the total farm site is 24 hectares.
Okay.
12 of that is forest and 12 of it is field.
Right.
The main program at the farm and the one that most students get involved with, although it is just the biggest of many, mm-hmm. is the market garden.
Okay.
And currently the market garden is expanding to occupy about a third to a half of that available 12-hectare field space.
Okay, so do you have any approximate numbers as to how many students or community members or professors or people in total get involved in the farm?
Well, last year we tried to keep a fairly good count, and over 1,100 students
wow.
used the farm last year, and that's including about 40 UBC classes.
So. Okay, so this is sort of integrated into certain classes at UBC. The profs will take them out and have them be out in the farm?
Oh, absolutely. And the potential is there to accommodate a lot more of that, so that's something we're trying to expand.
Okay, so moving on to a little bit of the more current news, we have been hearing some rumors, or some of us have, about what the future is of the farm. Can you talk to us a little bit in general about what you know of some of the tentative plans for the space?
Sure, I can. I think I'll start with going back with a little bit of the history of the land use decisions down at the farm.
Sure.
So as I stated, in the late 90s, there wasn't a lot happening down at the farm. And in 1997, the university released their official community plan. So many people don't know, but UBC's not actually part of Vancouver. It's mm-hmm. it's actually in what's called Electoral District A, which is just under the jurisdiction of the GVRD, or now Metro Vancouver. And so the UBC and the GVRD had a joint committee, and they released an official community plan.
Okay.
Basically, they're trying to increase housing on campus, doubling the number of people actually living on UBC campus. You can see the construction that's happening mm-hmm. all over the campus.
That's quite evident on campus.
Yeah. Yeah, so at that time, the UBC farm wasn't being used a whole lot,
okay.
and it was part of a total of 40 hectares, so the largest chunk of a 40-hectare package that was designated as future housing reserve. Basically, what that means is that the academic functions will continue there until such time as the university chooses to go back to the official community plan and make an amendment that will change that to residential, meaning that they wanted to build housing there.
Mm-hmm. So that's the implication, but what do we know about what is likely or unlikely to happen at this stage?
Well, things have been changing rapidly over the last year. Initially, when the official community plan came out, that decision was sort of slated for 2012. That was the loose kind of time that was put on it, that the university would take another look at what was at the farm and or the South Campus and that future housing reserve. Now the university has decided, or campus and community planning has decided, that because currently campus and community planning is going through a process of called the Vancouver campus plan. Mm-hmm. They're going through a process of really doing a campus plan right now. They've decided that the decision on the future housing reserve should be a part of that process. And that process is currently in phase four and is scheduled to wrap up in fall of 2008. And so we could be looking at a decision on the UBC farm as early as fall of 2008, but I expect it could take a lot longer than that as well.
Okay, so we've got a lot of information and a lot of dates, but it sounds as though there are some decisions pending that are sooner than you would have expected to happen.
Absolutely. And our concern right now is that the university actually recently put out a request for proposals to organizations in Vancouver to look at options for moving the UBC farm into one of the other areas in the future housing reserve. And basically, what that would mean is because, as I said, we're looking at a total of 24 hectares and 12 hectares of field at the farm right now. If the farm were to move to one of these other spots, it would be reduced to no more than 2 hectares.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a lot of groundwork that would have to be redone that has been, you know, created over the last couple decades.
A huge amount of groundwork, mm-hmm. Yeah. And particularly because we're trying to model sustainability at the farm. Sustainability is a long-term process, and so we've got 8 years of that building a sustainable system at the farm. We'd be starting back at square mm-hmm. one, and really we're looking at it as a decades-long process to really show a sustainable system, get something working out there. It also means that because currently we have this working farm, really like the last working farm in Vancouver, and the possibilities there are to really model and demonstrate a working farm. And so the students that come out there are really plugging into a full working system. If we were reduced to 2 hectares, we'd be looking at more of a just kind of field research plot kind of mm-hmm. thing. There is value to that, but it doesn't. We wouldn't be able to achieve the working farm status and you know showing a full right from you know. Very diverse amount of veggies and herbs and fruits and flowers and eggs or chickens in the field right through to marketing that. And we're able to do that now. And that kind of emergent property wouldn't be possible with just a 2-hectare field research site.
So what kind of feedback are you getting from people who are hearing about the concerns of the farm?
Well, with students, there's a big concern because people are really supporting that working farm and wouldn't and aren't nearly as interested in having a reduction, you know, wouldn't be nearly as interested in that kind of a field research plot, and also a huge amount of feedback coming in from the community, because another value of the farm in its current location, which wouldn't be possible anywhere else, is the real community amenity values. So we have a market at the farm. We have these community service learning gardens like the Urban Aboriginal Community Kitchen Garden that are real values to the community. We also have the community just coming out and being able to get involved in what's happening at the farm, whether that's volunteering, whether that's coming out to the market and just having their lunch out there, bringing their kids out to meet the chickens, mm-hmm. all of those kinds of things that are possible at a working farm that, you know, otherwise these people would have to go all the way out to the valley to access.
Okay, well, it sounds like there's a lot to learn about the past, present, and future state of the farm, so I encourage people to learn more about it. But what can you tell people who are interested maybe in coming out and getting involved in either saving the farm, as it's being termed, or even just coming and working on the farm?
Awesome. First of all, I'd like to say that we are meeting right now. If anybody is interested in getting involved in this process of just really promoting what the farm's all about, we meet every Tuesday at 6 p.m. in sub room 211, in the Student Union Building, room 211. There is an email, which, as you said, is Save the UBC Farm. So it actually is savetheubcfarm, all one word, @gmail.com. And there's a lot of information both on the UBC Farm website and on the Friends of the Farm website. I'm not going to read out those URLs. If you Google either Friends of the Farm or UBC Farm, then they're the first ones that come up. So.
Okay. So that's a quick and dirty way to sort of get down to the business of the farm. We're hoping to continue to hear news as to, you know, what's happening. And for listeners who want to hear more, go and do some research. Do you have any final comments you'd like to make?
Well, I would like to just say, in addition to sort of getting involved in, as we say, saving the farm or just campaigning for the farm, can also just get involved at the farm. Right. So we do have a volunteer program at the farm that is definitely, you know, most applicable to students, but also applicable to the community. And we encourage students to come down and, you know, if they want to do some directed studies research or just encourage their profs to bring their classes down, because there's all kinds of things that we can do down at the farm. So.
Okay, great. So that's a lot of information and people to learn, but go out and do some research, and we'll keep you posted on any new stuff happening with the farm. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but when we come back, we'll hear some local and provincial news. Stay tuned to News 101.
We've all heard about sweatshops. They're shops that employ workers at low wages, for long hours, and under very poor conditions.
Oxfam UBC is bringing awareness to the cause by holding the No Sweat Fashion Show. The main aim of the fashion show is to create awareness of the conditions in sweatshops of various clothing companies around the world. The information provided by the MCs will be about the negative aspects of sweatshops, along with the improvements made by certain companies for their workers.
The event is happening on March 19th from 12 to 1 p.m. inside the Student Union Building at UBC, near Starbucks. For more information, please email ubc.oxfam@gmail.com.
The Science Undergraduate Society is presenting Red Carpet, a live human labor auction and fashion show fundraiser for the charity Free the Children.
Red Carpet will feature dazzling fashion from 8 local designers. 19 popular students from groups across campus will be auctioning off their services in a live auction. As well, the event will have student performances in a fantastic talent show. And of course, food and great prizes, including grand prizes of gaming systems.
Red Carpet is being held Wednesday, March 19th from 5:30 until 8 p.m. at the Ladder Center at UBC. Entrance fee is by donation. Join us for a spectacular evening of glamour and fun.
See the Facebook group for more details or email pro.sus@gmail.com.
CITR. CITR 101.9 FM presents our second That DJ competition at the Pit, Thursday, April 3rd, 2008.
CITR Second That DJ Competition is looking for the most versatile party DJ in Vancouver.
It's quite simple. 8 DJs play 15-minute sets each, with a minimum of 3 genres of music to keep the party rocking.
There are no restrictions on what audio sources or what music style that DJ chooses to use. DJs must bring their own music and needle and provide their own transportation. The equipment provided will be properly functioning, professional quality equipment.
Interested? Send your demo to The DJ Competition, CITR Radio, 233-6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1, Canada.
Along with your full name, email address, mailing address, home or cell phone, your musical style, and audio sources used.
MySpace submissions are also accepted. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca or email thatdjcompetition2008, all one word, @gmail.com.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Rita Farkas. In addition to today's St. Patrick Day celebrations, it is also voting day for Vancouver Quadra riding residents and the residents of 3 other constituencies across the country. Voting in today's by-election will determine the next MP for the Vancouver riding, which includes UBC in it. This Member of Parliament will represent us in Ottawa. If you live on campus or nearby, you are likely to be included in the Vancouver Quadra riding. If you haven't already voted, polls are open until 8 p.m. this evening. If you haven't already registered, no problem. You can show up at the polls with a piece of picture ID and a piece of mail proving your address, and you will be registered on the spot. The polling station here on campus is in the Gage Towers Commons block. Now, with a look at some other local and provincial news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Carrie Baptist and Tracy Fuller.
The Golden Ears Bridge, which is scheduled to open to drivers during the summer of 2009, will be the first toll bridge in the Lower Mainland. In an effort to reduce traffic congestion caused by toll station waiting lines, TransLink plans to institute an electronic paying system. Drivers will be able to purchase a transponder to place in their car, which will electronically deduct the toll when you cross the bridge. TransLink's Ken Hardy says that drivers with a transponder will actually pay less than the other drivers because it costs more to collect toll in other ways, like with a license plate reader. Hardy doesn't think that drivers will congest other roadways trying to avoid paying the toll for the new bridge. He thinks that the utility of the new bridge will outweigh having to pay a toll. For the first month, though, of the bridge's operation, drivers will get to drive free to test out the new bridge and get the new system going. The Portman Bridge, which is proposed to be twinned with the Golden Ears Bridge, will open in 2013.
A new safety system is being installed in the 12 cranes working on the Olympic Village construction site to prevent them from crashing into each other. Concerns about the safety of the cranes arose due to the large number of cranes, which are all around the same height and located close together on the busy construction site. The new system will be installed this week. Each crane will be fitted with a sensitive alarm system that will warn the operator if the cranes are about to collide. If the cranes do get too close to one another, alarms will sound. If the crane operator is unable to stop the collision, the system will kick in and actually apply the brakes to the crane to avoid any kind of impact.
A proposal from TransLink Board of Directors would see a property tax hike to pay for the Transit Authority's $18 million budget shortfall. The deficit was caused by the cancellation of a two-year-old tax on the parking spots of businesses and shops in Metro Vancouver. If TransLink decides to recover the lost revenue through a property tax increase, the board estimates it would add about $13 to the tax bill of a home valued at about $500,000. TransLink says the idea to raise revenue through residential taxes has the support from the business community, which has been calling on TransLink to spread more of the tax burden to residential property owners ever since the controversial parking tax came into effect in 2006. TransLink will hold a public meeting tonight at the Burnaby Firefighters Hall. Members of the public are encouraged to attend to give input on the proposed new tax.
In provincial news, a proposed biomass power plant is meeting with opposition from local residents. The city of Prince George plans to build a plant which would generate power by burning biomass, including wood killed by the pine beetle. The energy would then be used to heat downtown buildings. Residents, however, of Prince George say that the power plant would only worsen the already poor air quality in the region. Provincial air quality advisories are frequently issued for Prince George. The project manager, Gina Latte-Liston, refutes claims that the biomass plant would substantially worsen air pollution, saying the proposed plant would only generate the equivalent air pollution of 8 extra city buses running per year. Opponents still hope to halt the project before July, when the federal government is set to hand over funding for the plant.
And in national news, two of Canada's largest airlines announced a fare increase today due to the rising cost of fuel. Air Canada and WestJet announced that the fares on some of their routes will increase now that the price of oil has hit $110 a barrel. Other airlines in the United States are taking similar action. Northwest, United, and Continental Airlines are all raising fares. A Canada Air representative, Peter Fitzpatrick, says the price hike is about more than oil, though. He says that the changing nature of the market and competition have all had an effect on flight pricing. Air Canada hasn't announced how much their fares are going to rise or which routes will be hit, but they have said that they hope to remain competitive as an airline.
And over to international news, an anti-war protest group recently held a demonstration at a Chevron facility in Richmond, California. With more news on that story, we turn to our friends from Free Speech Radio News.
Chevron is the third largest company in the U.S., seventh largest in the world. Last year, Chevron Phillips Chemical Company, also known as ConocoPhillips, made over $18 billion in profits, the highest amount ever made in its nearly 130-year history. Activists say that Chevron profits from domestic environmental racism and U.S. imperialism. The group Direct Action to Stop the War alleges that Chevron supported the Bush administration's attempts to force the Iraqi government to foreign investment and control. According to the Department of Energy, Chevron has been refining oil from Iraq at its Richmond refinery since the war began. On Saturday, activists blockaded a Chevron refinery in Northern California, the first move in a week of actions designed to bring the war home. FSRN's Puck Low files this report from Richmond, California.
A brass band accompanied more than 300 anti-war activists who marched to the refinery, where dozens sat with their arms locked down in PVC tubes blocking the street. Eventually, police arrested 24 of the protesters, who formed a human barricade outside the massive Chevron oil refinery. Chevron's Richmond refinery has long been contentious to many local residents who say the corporation is polluting low-income communities of color in the Bay Area. Richmond is directly across the San Francisco Bay from wealthy Marin County, but it is one of the most impoverished cities in the area, known for its depressed post-industrial economy and high rates of violence. And it has a long history of racist segregation. That's according to Mary Peacehead, a Richmond resident of 65 years.
After the war, they did not want black people around, so they built this community special for us.
That community is located downwind from the Chevron oil refinery. Head says that Chevron subsidizes many of Richmond's festivals and even social programs.
It's not a whole lot of rich people live in Richmond. It's a whole lot of donations that they give. It's a very few things that go on in Richmond that Chevron doesn't support.
But others argue that Richmond shouldn't have to rely on corporate donations to fund services.
All the money spent in the war could have been spent on our education and our community here.
Torm Nonpreseer is a Laotian immigrant who works with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. He says Southeast Asians make up 10% of Richmond's population. Many of them, including himself, are refugees of U.S. military invasions. Now most of them suffer from adverse health conditions they think are caused by pollution from the refinery.
Every time our community here die, we find out from doctor the result is always they have cancer. This cancer, that cancer. And also our young kid and our elder have a lot of asthma in our community.
It's a critical moment in the protracted battle between Chevron and its Bay Area opponents. At issue is a controversial proposal from Chevron. They want to replace several of its Richmond facilities and upgrade existing processing equipment. Local residents fear that the upgrades will allow Chevron to process dirtier, more polluting crude oils because they are cheaper. Jessica Tovar is with the environmental justice group, Communities for a Better Environment.
They're laying down the infrastructure to be able to process thicker crude oil, but they've disguised it as upgrades to the refinery.
Chevron officials, who have not returned phone calls at the time of this report, say the proposed change would not increase pollution. But Richmond's mayor, Gail McLaughlin, calls the environmental assessment submitted by Chevron incomplete.
Chevron, through this proposed project, wants to increase yearly greenhouse gas emissions 898,000 metric tons. This is not what our environment needs. And the sulfur and all the other, the volatile organic compounds, the flaring, all this is something that the environmental impact report needs to fully reveal, needs to tell us exactly what that impact is.
Eileen Suzara is a board member of Filipino-American Coalition for Environmental Solidarity. They work to build support for people in the Philippines who suffer from Chevron's toxic pollution there. Suzara says that environmental justice becomes transnational when U.S. residents pressure U.S. corporations to stop polluting in communities overseas, as well as in their home countries.
Right now, everyone is marching to go to the Chevron refineries here. And just over in San Ramon, there's the international headquarters for Chevron. So that's been an act of sight, saying that even though we're overseas, what's being decided by people who live here, the board of directors that lives here, shareholders that live here, these are, you know, intimately connected with the lives of people overseas.
The city will hold a public hearing on Chevron's application for the refinery upgrade this Thursday. In Richmond, California, this is Puck Lowe, Free Speech Radio News.
And thanks, as always, to FSRN for that piece. Right now, it's 5:29, and time to look back at this past weekend in UBC athletics. Here's Jason Wang with Thunderbird Eye on Sports.
Welcome to the special Irish edition of Thunderbird Eye Varsity Sports Report, where we connect with our audience of sports fans at their most attentive time of the year, right in the middle of happy hour on St. Paddy's Day. Alright, I can't keep that up. We begin with the BC AAA High School Boys Provincial Championship. The Yale Christians are provincial champions for the first time in school history, beating White Rock Christian 76-62 in the final. Yale's player of the game, Joel Friesen, couldn't be happier to win the championship with the teammates he's been playing ball with since they were all wee lads on the playground.
You know, when you grow up and, you know, we're out there in the gym every morning shooting, we grow as a team, our chemistry is really good, and it feels so good to win it because we know we deserve it. And we just work so hard, and the fact that it paid off is just amazing.
Moving on from high school to university hoops at the CIS Final Eight Championship. The UBC Thunderbirds men's team finished their season at the Nationals, placing sixth after an 86-84 defeat to the Laval Rouge Tour in Sunday's consolation final. T-Birds fourth-year guard Chris Dick lit up Laval for a tournament-high 37 points, but narrowly missed a three-pointer at the buzzer that would have been a game-winning shot. Laval's fifth-year senior Jean-Philippe Morin scored the team-high 21 points in the win for the Rouge Tour. On Saturday, UBC beat the St. Mary's Huskies 78-74 to advance to the fifth-place game, and earlier the T-Birds were relegated to the consolation round as they were defeated by the Brock Badgers 83-78. Brock went on to beat the Acadia Axemen 64-61 to win the CIS championship. This marks the end of a six-year dynasty for the Carleton Ravens. They lost their first game of the season to Acadia in the semifinal. But for the Thunderbirds, even though their playoff run at the Nationals once again fell short of the championship, they'll have their full contingent of players return to the team next season without losing anyone to graduation. From the hardwood to the diamond, UBC Thunderbirds baseball are a perfect 8-0 to open their regular season after winning all three home conference games against the Oregon Tech Hustlin' Owls at the Nat Bailey Stadium over the weekend. T-Birds beat Oregon Tech 10-1 to start Sunday's doubleheader before the Hustlin' Owls bounced back to win the exhibition nightcap 7-5. The loss won't hurt UBC in the standings. In Saturday's doubleheader, UBC's Mark Hardy pitched a complete game shutout with 7 strikeouts en route to a 3-0 victory. In Game 2, outfielder John Cernik hit 2-for-3 with 2 RBIs to pace the T-Birds to a 6-2 win. Coming up for the Thunderbirds, they'll go on a road trip to Idaho this coming weekend to take on the Lewis Clark State College Warriors for back-to-back doubleheaders. They will be non-conference exhibition games. This has been Jason Wang with your St. Patrick's Day edition of Thunderbird Eye Varsity Sports Report. You may now return to your Guinness.
And thanks to Jason Wang for that very entertaining and very pertinent for St. Patrick's Day piece. That's our program for March 17th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can always email news at citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, this is Rita Farkas thanking you for listening. Make sure to stay tuned for Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM CITR.